Okay, I know I'm kind of short, but can everybody hear me? We're good? Okay. So as Karen just said, thank you. I'm Kelly Bemis. I'm from suburban Cook County, Cook County Department of Public Health, and I just want to point out my boss here, Damien, as well. So if there are questions, we'll probably both be answering them at the end. Today I'm going to be describing our efforts to quantify the amount of TB transmission from smear-negative patients in our jurisdiction. So in 1989, after decades of sustained declines, the CDC set a goal of eliminating tuberculosis in the U.S. by 2010. However, in part due to complicating factors like the AIDS epidemic, increasing immigration, and reduced funding, by 2010, Stop TB USA estimated the U.S. was still 100 years away from achieving this goal. Since then, progress has continued to slow, and in 2015, the CDC reported the first increase in TB incidence in more than two decades. So while the increase was very minor, it does appear that progress towards elimination has stalled. Furthermore, funding for TB control activities continues to be unstable in many areas, including our own. In this context, it's essential that jurisdictions prioritize their available resources for TB control activities in the most efficient way possible. So one factor that's regularly used to prioritize TB control activities is a patient's smear status. Patients who produce sputum that is negative for the presence of Acinetobacter bacilli are presumed to be less infectious than patients whose sputum contains Acinetobacter bacilli. As a result, patients who are smear negative typically have less extensive contact investigations. So as you can see in the figure on the slide from the CDC guidelines for contact investigations, investigations for smear-negative patients are initiated only when sufficient resources are available. Smear-negative patients are also not usually isolated unless they're in high-risk occupations. But in spite of this, we know that these patients are still capable of transmitting TB. Three previous studies have attempted to quantify the amount of TB transmission that smear-negative patients are responsible for. Each of these studies looked at patients that were clustered by genotype, or for those of you who are not familiar with genotype, essentially have matching strains of TB, and found that among these patients, smear-negative individuals were responsible for between 13% and 26% of all transmission. So if these estimates are correct, that means that as many as one in four secondary TB cases are caused by a smear-negative index case. Each of these studies concluded that countries with enough resources should expand TB control efforts for smear-negative patients. And this sentiment is routinely echoed in our jurisdiction by TB physicians. However, we think it's worth examining how these studies were actually conducted. So each of these studies shared a common methodology, and hopefully the example will make this somewhat clear. So first, the patients were organized into clusters based on matching genotype. So again, all of these patients are assumed to have essentially the same strain of TB. Patients in the cluster were then put in chronological order based on their date of diagnosis. And then each instance in which a smear-negative patient preceded another patient in the cluster was counted as an instance of smear-negative transmission. So in this example on the slide, we have two transmission events, one smear negative transmission event from the person in red here to the person in orange, and one smear positive transmission event from the person in orange to the person in blue. So in this very small example, 50% of TB transmission, one of these two events, was attributable to a smear negative patient. So unfortunately, this methodology doesn't account for all the different patterns of transmission that can be seen among patients who share a common genotype. When you count transmission events in this way, it assumes that all transmission occurs in this pattern represented on the slide, that patient A in red infects patient B in orange. And while that does occur, it could also be that patient B actually infected patient A, but patient B's diagnosis was delayed or they incorrectly remembered their symptom onset. And a third scenario, possibly the most frequent, is that patient A and patient B are actually completely unconnected, but were both latently infected with a common strain of TB in their country of origin. Finally, patient A and patient B might have been infected by another patient who was never diagnosed, never identified, or whose TB strain was never genotyped. So for this reason, the CDC recommends that genotype information should be considered in context with other evidence before determining the most likely transmission pattern between two patients. Other evidence to consider includes whether the patients have been epidemiologically linked during interviews or investigation, for example, if they frequent the same bar or attend the same church, and whether the cases are clustered in space and time. Finally, consideration should also be given to whether the patients have the same drug susceptibility profile. So given this information, we hypothesized that the previous studies evaluating transmission based on genotype and chronology of diagnosis may be overestimating the proportion of transmission due to smear-negative patients. We believe that considering both genotype information as well as epi links will produce smaller estimates of smear-negative transmission when compared to estimating based on genotype alone. So to test this hypothesis, we completed two analyses. First, we calculated the proportion of smear-negative transmission in suburban Cook County using the methodology I just described used in the published literature. Then we repeated that calculation, but this time we focused on whether any epidemiologic links between the clustered patients had been established. We began by selecting all culture-positive TB cases reported between January 2009 and February 2016. These patients were then organized into clusters based on CDC genotype, and if there's more interest at the end of the presentation, I can go into more detail about genotype, but for now, the most essential information is that patients who share the same genotype are again assumed to have the same strain of TB. Genotype is assigned based on the results of two different PCR tests that look for patterns in different parts of the Mycobacterium tuberculosis genome. This method of genotyping has been in use at the CDC since 2009 and is more specific than the method that was being used previously. For each genotype cluster, patients were organized chronologically by symptom onset. Smear negative and smear positive transmission events were counted. In the first analysis, smear negative transmission events were counted whenever a case was preceded by only smear negative patients in the cluster. So again, the methodology we just went through. And then in the second analysis, smear negative transmission events were counted whenever a case was preceded by a smear negative case and the two cases were epi-linked. For each analysis, the proportion of transmission attributable to smear negative patients was calculated by dividing the number of smear negative transmission events by the total number of transmission events. And the relative transmission rate compared to smear positive patients was also calculated. During our time period of interest, 455 culture-positive TB cases were reported to the health department. 81% of those cases had a known genotype. Cases with known genotype were not statistically different from the remaining cases based on age, sex, race, ethnicity, or country of origin. Of the cases with a known genotype, 84% were unique, meaning they did not match any other case in our jurisdiction. And the remaining 60 patients were organized into 26 genotype clusters. Within these 26 clusters, there were 34 total transmission events. However, four index patients had an unknown smear status. With these patients excluded, we had a denominator of 30 transmission events for all analyses. When smear negative transmission events were counted using the published literature methodology, we identified 8 smear negative events. By this methodology, 27% of all TB transmission in suburban Cook County would be attributed to smear negative patients. Smear-negative patients are 22% as likely as smear-positive patients to transmit TB, again, according to this methodology. But to get a better sense of what this data looks like in practice, we thought it might be useful to examine a few case studies of smear-negative clusters that contributed to this calculation. So in the first cluster, there were two patients, a 26-year-old male and a 37-year-old male, both from the Philippines. The first patient in the cluster was smear negative, but the next patient wasn't diagnosed until more than 2 years later. The patients live over 50 miles apart and have no known epi links between them. And the TB strain they share is the third most common in the U.S. So by the previous methodology, this would be counted as smear negative transmission, but it seems to be much more likely a case of independent reactivations. The transmission pattern at work in the next cluster is more ambiguous. Again, these patients are from similar parts of the world, and we could not establish any epi link between them. But they are somewhat clustered in space and time. So in the absence of epi links, clusters like these, it's very difficult for health departments to determine whether recent transmission actually occurred here or whether you're just looking at a coincidence of closely clustered independent reactivations. In the third cluster, two 33-year-old males from Mexico were diagnosed 2 months apart. During the investigation, it was discovered that both men lived and worked in close quarters at a horse racing track. So at first glance, this appears to be a clear case of smear negative transmission supported by genotype match and EpiLink. But when case one was later re-interviewed, he named case two without any prompting and noted that case two had been, quote, coughing for months, well before the symptom onset that was documented in case two's record. So in light of this information, it appears more likely that case two actually infected case one, making this a smear positive transmission event. And in the final cluster, two patients were also epidemiologically linked. The smear negative index case was a 49-year-old female who worked in a daycare. During the contact investigation, a 2-year-old male with parents from Russia had a positive tuberculin skin test. So initially it was suspected that the 2-year-old might have been exposed elsewhere, maybe from a relative or someone else in the community, given the index patient's smear negative status. But further interviews revealed that case two was case one's favorite child in the daycare, and they had extensive close contact. Then a gastric wash from the child revealed a genotype match supporting the epi work. But most importantly, case one ended up having a positive bronchial wash. Though she was smear negative, CDC guidelines recommend that bronchial washes be treated as equivalent to sputum. And as far as we're aware, none of the previous literature had considered bronchial washes in addition to smear status. However, we believe clusters like these should actually be counted, again, as a smear positive transmission event. So with those two previous clusters reclassified, leaving all else the same, the number of smear negative transmission events drops from 8 to 6 for a smear negative transmission proportion of 20%. So using the same methodology as the published literature produced an estimate in line with their findings, which had ranged from 13% to 26%. However, those last two misclassified clusters show the importance of using EPI information when you're estimating smear negative transmission. So when we extend this logic further, as we did in our final analysis, we considered smear negative transmission events only counted when a smear negative patient had a matching genotype and was also epi-linked to the patient that came after them in the cluster. Using this definition, incorporating all epi-links, only two smear negative transmission events were identified. As a result, the proportion of transmission attributed to smear negative patients dropped from 20% to only 7%, much lower than the smallest estimate in the current published literature. We acknowledge that epi-links are imperfect as well, and so the true proportion of smear negative transmission is likely somewhere between these two estimates. So in conclusion, introducing epidemiologic data reduced estimates of smear negative transmission by more than half. While the true proportion of TB transmission attributable to smear negative patients remains unknown, our findings suggest that the estimates in the published literature may be too high. These studies suggested that based on their results, more resources should be devoted to smear negative case investigations. However, we believe in this climate, resources might be better directed at other efforts, such as reducing the burden of latent infection. And finally, our results highlight how complex it can be to interpret chains of transmission between clustered patients in the absence of EPI data. We hope that additional research will be published to better estimate smear negative transmission and to assist health departments in determining when matching genotype data indicates recent transmission. I'd like to end by acknowledging our TB control program and nursing staff, and to also ask for feedback during the question and answer period. If any TB control programs in the audience have done work like this, if you've studied smear negative transmission or what your experience has been with smear negative patients, your opinion on these estimates and whether more work needs to be done in this area. And with that, I'll thank everyone for their attention. Thanks.
We've got about 5 minutes for questions, so if you have a question, please come to the microphone in the middle aisle.
I've got a question for you. So one of the really interesting innovations with this is the genotype characterization, right? How feasible is that, do you think, moving forward to do this on a regular basis with not just TB but other kind of respiratory pathogens?
Oh, I feel like that would probably be a question for CDC. I mean, that infrastructure, you know, I think as a local health department, we're really dependent on the laboratories at the state and federal level to assist us in that effort. And certainly the case in Illinois is that funding for laboratory work does not seem to be going up in the near future, unless your perception is different. So I would say that in the absence of a crisis or a groundswell of support, it certainly doesn't seem to me at the local level that we'll be seeing a lot of movement in that area. I don't know if your experience is different, Heather.
No, it absolutely is the same.
Yeah.
But this is an area that I think is really interesting in terms of moving forward on. What do you think your capacity is at the local level to continue doing this kind of important work?
As long as we have support from the federal government, I think we'd be fine. But if we were to ever have to genotype anything on our own, or if we had difficulties with getting specimens to CDC, I think we'd have some trouble. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think currently the resources are better spent trying to get those isolates from all the hospitals where those cases may be seen, and then making sure that they get to the state and to the reference lab, so we have a complete picture of the cases we see.
Yeah.
And then obviously, we're right outside the city of Chicago, so collaborating with the city, the borders are porous, obviously, so a lot of our cases are other cases of this person.
Okay, thank you.
I do have a question, and I'm not going to jump over my lovely teammates here. Do you routinely do contact investigation on seronegative TB cases?
Yes. I don't know if you would add any limiting factors to that.
We tend to not go into a school or a workplace unless there's an extenuating circumstance. But yeah, we do household investigations on all cases.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How did you guys define EpiLink?
If our investigators could concretely say these two patients had something in common.
Okay, so was that through contact investigation?
Yes. So that, again, for these patients where, we know that information can be incomplete. So for those patients where it seems like there's something there, but you can't concretely point to one thing where these patients were in the same place at the same time, I think those are the most challenging clusters to figure out what to do in those situations. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.